Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. ''1968 was a unique year in history, when explosive social movements shook almost every country in the world. Among other things, it was the bloodiest year of the Vietnam War, the year of the Biafran Civil War in which 1 million children starved to death, a critical year in the Middle East, a year of uprisings in the Communist bloc, the year of student riots in Rome, Madrid, Berlin, Paris, London, Berkeley, and elsewhere, the year of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy's assassinations, and the year of Richard Nixon's election. The central question is, why did all of these events happen in diverse countries over different issues, but often in very similar ways, at the exact same moment? I'll address that question in my interview this week with Mark Kurlansky, the author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. After that, Robert Brent Toplin will offer us his thoughts on how the nation's response to American involvement in Iraq has differed from its response to the war in Vietnam. And Kelly Schramm will report on another of her historical sites on the web, this one devoted to another major development of the 1960s, the pill. But first, as we do each week, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed. We at Talking History recognize Americans' obsession with lists. Lists of the best and the worst of just about everything. Well, we have another list for you this week, a very specialized list that we think will interest you. It's a list of the 10 most harmful books in the 19th and 20th centuries, as determined by the national conservative weekly, Human Events. The magazine asked a panel of 15 conservative scholars to compile a list of what they consider to be the most harmful books of the past two centuries, and this is what resulted, in order of the most to the least harmful. The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, published in 1848. Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler, published in 1925-1926. Quotation from Chairman Mao, published in 1966 by Chinese Chairman Mao Zedong. The Kinsey Report by Alfred Kinsey, published in 1948. John Dewey's Democracy in Education, published in 1916. Das Kapital, written by Karl Marx and published in 1867-1894. The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, which appeared in 1963. The Course of Positive Philosophy by Auguste Comte, published in 1830-1842. Frederick Nietzsche's 1886 book, Beyond Good and Evil. And General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money by John Maynard Keynes, published in 1936. To find out more about these books and why the panelists considered them so harmful, go to www.humaneventsonline.com. And on a 1960s-related event, a recent article by Robin Erb in the Toledo, Ohio Blade recalls that the John F. Kennedy presidency almost ended before he was inaugurated. The date was December 11, 1960. Richard Pavlik stopped a short distance from the Palm Beach, Florida house where President-elect John Kennedy was vacationing and preparing to leave for Sunday Mass. Pavlik's plan was to ram Kennedy's car with his own, which was loaded with sticks of dynamite. When Kennedy emerged, however, Pavlik decided to abort his plan and try again at the church or elsewhere. What gave him pause was the presence of the president's wife, Jacqueline, and their children, Caroline and John Jr. Pavlik, age 73, never had a second chance. He was arrested the following Thursday by authorities acting on information they received about his deep hatred for Kennedy. Word of the assassination attempt was quickly hushed at the time, apparently by the White House and the Secret Service for fear of potential copycats. Details would not be forthcoming until U.S. Secret Service Chief U.E. Bauman wrote his memoirs 2 years later. Pavlik confessed to the assassination plan, but he was declared mentally incompetent to stand trial and was sent to federal mental institutions where he remained until he was released in 1966 without ever having stood trial. Next up, more on the 1960s, on 1968 in particular, with Mark Kurlansky. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
There's never been a year like 1968, and it's unlikely that there will ever be one again. So writes our guest this week, Mark Kurlansky, in his latest book, 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. Kurlansky is no stranger to talking history. His most recent appearance was last summer when we discussed his book, Salt, A World History. Welcome back, Mark.
Nice to be back.
Why 1968? Remind us of what happened in that year.
Well, 1968 began with the Koreans hijacking the Pueblo, a U.S. naval vessel. There was the Tet Offensive. It was the worst year of the Vietnam War. The incumbent and tremendously popular President Johnson decides not to win after narrowly winning a New Hampshire primary. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. It was the year of the Prague Spring. Czechoslovakia's attempt to have a democratic communism, the year of social upheaval in Poland and much of the Soviet bloc, but also in Paris and Berlin and London and Rome and Madrid and Mexico City, the year of many, many violent demonstrations, the year of the Biafran Civil War, the year of the rise of Yasser Arafat, the first successful heart transplant, the first space shot to orbit the moon, on and on and on.
The list goes on.
Right. In the language of journalism, it was an astounding news cycle.
Right. And it's interesting because I think you make a good point. I'm glad you approached it the way you did to remind us that it isn't just what happened in the United States, although most of us tend to focus on that. We're talking about a worldwide event.
Absolutely. And what's so fascinating about that is that the world was not connected the way it is today. There was, of course, no internet, but even international telephone calls were very rare. And many of these countries, including France, not that many people had telephones. To have global events was a pretty rare thing at the time. And all of these movements, they weren't in touch with each other.
Okay, I want to come back to that in a minute, but preliminary question. Other than the sheer number of things, is there anything else that makes 1968 unique in your mind?
Yeah, in a sense, it's partly a coincidence that there were so many events, but there was this phenomena of the social upheaval, the mostly student and youth movements that existed in almost every country in the world. And these countries were so different. I mean, Mexico and Japan and Franco's Spain and de Gaulle's France and countries of the Soviet bloc. I mean, just the fact that 20-year-olds in the Soviet bloc and 20-year-olds in the West were doing the same things and saying the same things was an amazing phenomena, a kind of global phenomena like had never existed before.
Why do you think that happened? What brought it about?
It was caused by a number of things, some of which were long range and some of which were more specifically 1968, starting with the fact that people who were born after World War II or grew up after World War II, I was born in 1948, for example, saw the world very differently from people who grew up before the war. Mainly because World War II changed the world a lot. We grew up in a different reality. We grew up with atomic bombs, which gave a very different way of looking at warfare. We also grew up with a knowledge of the Holocaust, which gave a very different way of looking at the importance of political activism and the moral obligation to speak out.
And how would that shape their thinking when they became young adults?
In a number of ways, it gave the sense that we were responsible, that we had an obligation to speak out, and it also gave us a deep suspicion and distrust of the generation of our parents, which is to say not only our parents, but the people who were running things. This meant if you were a Polish or Czechoslovakian student from a good communist family, that you were questioning the difference between what good communism was supposed to be and the reality of what was going on in a Soviet bloc country. Or it meant that if you were in the United States, even if you were in a leftist family, you would be suspicious of that old leftism, the old Roosevelt New Deal. If you listen to the popular culture of the late 60s, It's all about this sense that the world is changing and we're moving forward to better things, and history is being made, and you have to either understand this or get out of the way.
You know, that's interesting, because other books on this time period, and I think you strike out new directions here, because they're so focused on the United States, tend to only look at those factors that help shape young adults in the post-war period in the United States. But you're now taking that beyond to a global perspective.
You can look at, in Mexico, for example, the students were largely from families that were good pre-families, the pre being the ruling party of Mexico from the revolution until just a few years ago. And they were the first generation of Mexicans to question the Mexican Revolution and to question the idea that the Mexican Revolution had brought democracy and equality to Mexico. Clearly it hadn't, but nobody was saying that because they had the revolution and they were committed to it. And here were young Mexicans saying for the first time, why is it that this revolution has created this emerging middle class, but the peasants and the workers are still impoverished? This bothers us. This troubles our conscience. This is something you find all over the world. You find young people of the emerging affluent middle class. Tom Hayden, who wrote the Port Huron Statement, which was brilliant in its ability to sum up this thinking, this global thinking, begins by saying, we of the privileged middle class. In Mexico, people of the privileged middle class wanted to know why this growth in the economy was only helping them. This was something all over the world. So often, you know, you find in the Soviet bloc that these students were of privileged families because they were good communists. And why wasn't communism living up to what Marx had promised?
Okay, so, and again, I don't want to drive this too hard or belabor it too far, but again, when we think of 68, we think civil rights movement, and you're suggesting this isn't limited to the United States. We think of the alienated generation, and again, you're very clear, this is just not an alienated generation in the United States. We think of Vietnam War, same response.
Right. The civil rights movement was very important all over the world. In the United States, many of the important activists of the 60s, Mario Sevilla, Tom Hayden, many of them came out of the civil rights movement. But also in the rest of the world, civil rights movement was very media savvy and got on television a lot. It also happened to be at the time when television news expanded from 15 minutes to half an hour, and that second 15 minutes was largely in the South, the civil rights movement. Right. And people were very moved by what they were doing. And it kind of put protest in the air. It implanted this idea, especially in young people all over the world, that the way to deal with things was to protest and to invent ways of protesting, which is what the civil rights movement did. You know, the sit-in at the lunch counter and boycotts and the freedom riding on buses. And as problems came up, they invented new ways of protesting them with street action, very public action that could be put on television. And this was imitated by many young people in all of these movements all over the world.
Okay. You certainly make a case it's a momentous year, but you also write that it's a momentous year that really leads us to where we are today. Explain that.
Well, in many ways, I always say that it's a mistake to think of history in terms of beginnings and ends. History flows. There's no real spot where it begins, which is how I accidentally became a historian, because I just try to tell a story and you have to go back. And it doesn't end. And there's this thing that is constantly used, a disagreement on the exact date, but when the 60s died. You know, the 60s didn't die. It keeps going. It created the environmental movement and the women's movement and the gay rights movement. But it also created the political configuration we have today in this country. Was very consciously created by Richard Nixon in 1968 as a way of working with the realities that were there at that particular moment. Richard Nixon set out to completely destroy the moderate wing of the Republican Party, which had been the dominant wing. the so-called Rockefeller Republicans. In January 1968, all the pundits and pollsters said that Nelson Rockefeller was the only Republican who had a prayer. Nobody thought Nixon had a chance. Nixon, when he chose Spiro Agnew for his running mate and outraged the Republican Party, somebody who was to the right of Nixon, where everybody expected Nixon to pick a liberal, a moderate, and that it would be this dream package. And it was Nixon's idea that the Republican Party would not be a party of consensus, it would be a party of the right, and in so doing would become the party of the South, which had always been the Democratic Party, because for 100 years Southerners had continued to vote for John C. Calhoun against Abraham Lincoln. That political construct that he created is, of course, very much with us today. The famous blue and red map was Richard Nixon's map for politics.
Right, good point. Also with us today is sort of a memory, if you will, of 1968, which isn't just based on the facts, but also the idea that despite the confrontation and the upset and the anger, even tragedy, the assassinations taking place in that year, we tend to romanticize it, to be nostalgic about 1968. Very briefly, why do we do that, do you think?
I think that there are several reasons why. It was a pivotal year in popular culture, a great year for theater, a great year for poetry, and in some ways, a lot of fun. But I think that the most important reason why people look back fondly on 68, and why I think right now they're especially looking back on 68, was that 1968 was a time in which people all over the world felt they had a voice. That if nothing else, they could stand on the street and scream.
Mm-hmm. And they did.
And they did. And, you know, you stood on the street and screamed in 1968, and a few hundred people would scream with you, and maybe 1,000 and maybe 100,000, and TV would always cover it. You know, we have demonstrations today, and tens of thousands of people protested George Bush's inauguration, and it barely made it
right
into a newspaper or onto television. Mm-hmm. You put something on the street in 1968, and television just loved it. And the result of all this was that people felt empowered. They felt that they had a voice and that they had a way of dealing with this deep feeling in their conscience that they had to speak out. People today feel very troubled about things that are going on, but they feel they have no voice. They feel that there's nothing they can do. There's no way they can be heard. And this is a very frustrating and troubling sensation. And so I think they're looking back to a time when people did feel empowered.
Okay, good. Very good. Well, that's where we'll have to end it. We're out of time. But thanks for joining us.
Pleasure talking to you.
Come back for a third time.
I gladly will.
Very good. I've been speaking with Mark Kurlansky, the author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World, published by Random House. And this is Talking History.
Hey, Jude, could I be blessed?
As we just heard, 1968 was one of the bloodiest years of American military involvement in Vietnam. It was also one of increased protest against the war. For our guest commentary of the week, Robert Brent Toplin compares the nation's reaction to American involvement in Vietnam to our response to our current military action in Iraq. Toplin is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington.
Many have pointed out that the United States' current problems in Iraq resemble our nation's earlier difficulties in Vietnam, but few have observed that conditions at home in America today are very different than those of 40 years ago. strong public resistance to an unpopular foreign intervention, so evident in the 1960s, is missing today. We hear familiar sounds of war in Iraq, but not many familiar sounds of protest in the USA. The United States is occupying Iraq indefinitely. Officials in the Defense Department indicate that the troops will not leave until the Iraqis can effectively handle their own security. Creating a stable and secure Iraq could take 10 or 20 years, possibly longer. In Vietnam, the goals of occupation were never achieved, despite decades of American intervention. When Americans of the 60s questioned the morality of their nation's policies and suspected that their troops were walking into a quagmire, they quickly and impressively expressed their disapproval. Tens of thousands and later hundreds of thousands participated in demonstrations in Washington, D.C. and other cities. Politicians acted vigorously, too, in the 60s. When Democrats became unhappy with Lyndon B. Johnson's policies in Vietnam, they criticized the president sharply. It did not matter to them that the man in the White House happened to be a Democrat. By 1966, just a year after major United States combat operations got underway in Vietnam, the Senate's 66 Democrats were almost evenly split between opponents of the war and those who wished to stay the course under Johnson's leadership. Why is protest by our political leaders in Congress and by the American people in the streets so less evident today than it was in the 60s? Does the current war seem less compelling to Americans because there is no military draft as in the Vietnam War days? Whatever the reason, it seems clear that political leaders are not going to change course and pull out of Iraq on their own. If leaders in Washington do not hear the American people calling out, "Support our troops, bring them home," they are unlikely to act. That's the way democracy works.
You've been listening to Robert Brent Toplin, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Toplin is the author of History by Hollywood, The Use and Abuse of the American Past, and his latest publication, Real History, R-E-E-L History, that is, in Defense of Hollywood, published by the University Press of Kansas. This is Talking History. Finally, the pill is one of the most praised and criticized medical developments of the 1960s, but its history and that of birth control in general is long and fascinating. Talking History regular Kelly Schrum is here to tell you about a virtual site where you can learn more about this history. Schrum is the Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
What it gave me was the sense of ownership of myself. It was sexual freedom. It changed the relationship between men and women. It meant you could make your own decisions and not have to constantly be thinking about, is this going to change my life? It separated sex from all those dangerous aspects. It had a profound effect on how we began to think about all sorts of things, about being able to continue a career without fear of interruption. The IT is the pill, first approved by the FDA in 1960 for use as birth control. Designed as a companion to the PBS film, this website documents the development of the birth control pill and its effect on women and women's health. The site offers a synopsis of the film and a dozen primary sources, including letters between birth control researchers. The site also includes a timeline that documents references to birth control as far back in history as the Bible. A gallery showcases approximately 15 birth control package designs, from a small brown glass bottle to daily dispensers. People and Events introduces researchers, including Margaret Sanger, who dedicated years to the issue of birth control, as well as milestones in the pill's development. Special Features uses a flash presentation to demonstrate how the pill works to prevent pregnancy, explores the many shifts in attitudes that have been attributed to the pill, and asks viewers to participate in an online poll. A teacher's guide features lesson plans and presents challenging exercises for students. One exercise asks students to survey the effect geography had on sexual attitudes by comparing state laws about contraception in 1960. Although the site is not a comprehensive archive, the primary sources and multimedia exhibits make it valuable, especially for research into birth control and the 1960s. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu. Type pill into the keyword search.
The week of June 27th, we aired an interview with David Herlihy, author of The Bicycle, A History. David Herlihy would like to clarify that he misspoke when discussing the high wheeler and said solid iron tires when he meant to say solid rubber tires.
That's it for another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. For more information on Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.